This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Just as the Curiosity rover was plunking down on Mars in August of 2012, one of the NASA mission's members was skyrocketing to internet fame. Babak Ferdowsi, also known as Mohawk Man, captured public attention with his mold-breaking mane. And while Ferdowsi still has his NASA day job, he's become a national figure that challenges the image of the traditional nerdy scientist. What does his impact on pop culture say about our national enthusiasm for space exploration? And can NASA ride the seeming wave of popularity to support for future missions, like putting people on Mars? Babak Ferdowsi is currently Europa Clipper Mission Engineer at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, JPL, in Pasadena, California. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks for having me.
Are you tired of this?
I love it. I think it's been such a positive experience. People have been so kind of excited to come up and, you know, relate their stories of either their Curiosity landing or, you know, their kids' interest in science or robotics. So it's been really fun.
Mm-hmm. Are you the first guy to wear a mohawk at JPL?
I'm sure I'm not the first. and I, you know, there are a lot of some pretty cool looking guys who rock some pretty cool hairstyles. We had some mullets back in the day.
We're still talking about it. Why do you think the hair captured such national attention?
I've got to guess that it's just not what people expected. You know, the last time people saw a NASA control room really in kind of in a large scale was probably either Apollo 13 or during the shuttle. And that's 20, 30 years, you know, before our time. So I think people just hadn't, you know, realized that scientists and engineers today have evolved just like the rest of society. And if you looked at that control room, it was a pretty young control room. It was full of people who looked in different ways. And then I guess I stood out a little bit more than I expected.
Do you think that the image is key to getting young people interested in becoming engineers and involved in the space program?
You know, I think it's important always for kids to see someone that they can relate to in any an environment, somebody that, you know, reminds them of themselves in some way. So, you know, kids have fun haircuts. They see, you know, they see women in the control room. There are girls who want to go into engineering and sciences. So I think that's a good, important part. And I want to see kids, you know, feel connected to what we do.
Yeah, because there's a lot of popularity and celebrity in space and in NASA. And you see them popping up all over the place now. It's become part of the culture again. Like we used to say in my day, hip, you know, to have these things happen.
I love it. You know, I was driving around the other night and I saw, you know, an ad for, I think it was Ray-Ban or something. And there's somebody, you know, clearly wearing like a NASA flight suit. But it's definitely become sort of the pop, you know, lexicon in advertising and movies and things like that. So It's an exciting time for space, even if you're not necessarily a diehard space buff.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that. Post-Curiosity, what missions are you working on at JPL? Let's talk about the Europa mission.
I am so excited. So Europa is a study. You know, for years, we've thought Europa is a very kind of exciting place. It's the second moon of Jupiter. It's got this icy crust. We think there's a good kind of watery ocean underneath there, and then a rocky core. And, you know, where on Earth we see that water and rocky sort of stuff interact, like the bottom of the oceans, there's life. So, you know, we're optimistic that in a Europa that's kind of kept warm by tidal heating in Jupiter, that the same chances kind of could exist. And we think water's been there a very long time, so it kind of has time for life to arise.
Is there an actual mission plan to go?
There
funded,
is.
Well, ready, you know?
So there's not a
on
mission.
On the drawing board.
That's right. We're still in the study phase.
Yeah.
But, you know, the recent events in Congress and certainly at NASA and everybody, you know, there's a kind of an increasing motive to go to Europa. It's been basically the second highest priority in what we call the decadal survey, which is when the science community gets together and decides what places should we be looking at next. So it's been a very high priority after Mars for a very long time. And I think it's building momentum towards what's going to be a project in the next couple of years.
You know, it's interesting because even way back 50-so years ago, 60, Arthur C. Clarke, right?
He did.
He picked the spot. How did he know?
I mean, well, Clarke was an astute student of astrophysics. He was a member of the Royal Astronomy Society. And so, you know, I think he knew his stuff. He even kind of came up with some of the ideas for GPS that we use nowadays.
Yeah.
So, you know, you could look at Jupiter. We knew it was this icy moon, but now we're seeing, you know, just more and more evidence, even from Hubble images now, that we think we can see water plumes shooting off the southern pole of Europa. I mean, the idea that there's water that's coming off of this, that's a pretty exciting, you know, bit of information.
Even there was news about Enceladus, right?
So Enceladus,
that was a different, different moon.
Enceladus also, which is the moon of Saturn, has water. And so I think what we're learning as we kind of explore the solar system is that there's a lot more kind of chances out there for these little places, nooks and crannies for life to kind of pop up.
So somebody somewhere is probably looking at this somewhere and saying, should we go to Enceladus instead of Europa?
There are definitely fans of both camps. And there's, you know, you can make a case for both. Probably the strongest case is the fact that the Decadal Survey says, that's what the science community says, you know, we'd like to go to Europa. But yeah, Enceladus is a fascinating place. I know that, you know, Charlie Bolden, the administrator of NASA, has definitely made the comment, well, this is tough news. Now I have to decide between one or the other.
Hey, should he say, let's go to both places, right?
You know, I hope that's the case. I hope we, I mean, and I think we will. But obviously a mission that's focused around kind of water is always, you know, better.
You think that this is a good time to be doing what you're doing?
I think this is kind of a golden age for space exploration. You know, not just because the planetary, you know, information is growing. We have missions like Kepler, you know, finding these Earth-like exoplanets around other stars. We have a commercial space industry that's actually growing. You know, recently we have this announcement in the commercial space industry from SpaceX announcing a Dragon
Elon
capsule.
Musk.
Elon Musk, yeah, company.
Yeah.
You know, crew capsule for seven people to go to Earth orbit. And the fact that we have kind of a growing commercial space industry means that NASA can even focus more and more on, I think, the stuff that, you know, we always wanted to do, which is let's go explore the solar system. Let's go explore the galaxy.
Tell us a bit about how you first got excited about going into science and engineering.
Well, we mentioned Arthur C. Clarke a little bit earlier, and he's definitely one of the reasons why I loved, you know, this vision of the future. He always presented a very positive, kind of a collaborative human vision of the future of exploration.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, you know, rooted in a lot of real scientific fact or knowledge that he had at the time. You have folks like Isaac Asimov. Obviously, those kind of books were the books I read as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have, you know, the more pop culture. Like, I loved Star Trek growing up. And again, it, you know, as a globe, we come together to explore the cosmos. And I think that always resonated with me.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't until 1997 with Pathfinder where I think I had a really strong focus. I think I liked space. But
did you have a mentor, somebody who pushed you in that direction?
Or I had a couple of really great teachers who encouraged sort of my scientific, I guess, growth. My third grade teacher, Mr. Baum, and then my 10th and 11th grade teacher, Mr. Chambers. They both really encouraged me, I think, to be excited about science. But I think it was, you know, Pathfinder happened right as I graduated high school in the summer of 97. And just for the first time, really, since I grew up, seeing pictures coming back, you know, from another world, that was amazing. And it's so different because as a student of science now, I can appreciate maybe more of what Cassini does and, you know, seeing understanding the intricacy of that system, of the Saturn system.
Mm-hmm.
But as a kind of a younger high school student, the idea of seeing a remote control car, something that humans built sitting on the surface of another planet, I think that's what really was like, that's what I want to do. I want to see, you know, that's the human element of it. And that's what made it kind of more relatable to me. And so when I went to college, I studied aerospace engineering and kept following that path until I managed to find my way into NASA.
Wow, that's good. Did you have to bounce around a while before you got to NASA?
I didn't. I was very fortunate. I had a classmate who graduated the year before me.
Right.
And he got hired at JPL. And as soon as I graduated, I was like, hey, I like that. I want to do that kind of thing. And luckily, it worked out. And the first thing I worked on at JPL was this Mars Curiosity. At the time, just called Mars Science Laboratory. We didn't have a name for it yet.
Right. You talked about the privatization, the commercialization of space. Would you take a ride on the Virgin Galactic?
I would definitely
spacecraft?
I would definitely take a ride on that. I think it's such a great idea. I like, you know, that they've come up with this sort of relatively inexpensive, I'm not going to call it cheap yet, but hopefully comes down in price. And the idea that you get some experience, kind of a few minutes of weightlessness, you get to see the, you know, the black of space, the curvature of the Earth. I would like to see the Earth from that perspective.
Mm-hmm. What about collaborating with other countries on missions? Do you think that's in the stars, so to speak, for us with China or with India, Japan?
Well, there's always a political challenge sometimes with certain countries and the trade restrictions that we have on information. But, you know, take an example like Curiosity. You know, we have contributions from Spain, from France, Canada,
mm-hmm.
Russia. So all of these, you know, countries have added components to make that come together. And I think international collaboration is the only way we're really going to get to the really hard stuff. You know, I don't think we do a only American mission to Mars in the future. I don't think that's the kind of thing that is both cost effective or really what we want to do with the space program. I think space, kind of the wonderful thing for me and for a lot of us who I think work in the field, is it's a very human endeavor. I mean, it's not, you know, the moment Curiosity landed, I'm very proud of the American accomplishment, but I thought that was like, as a human, I'm so excited for this. Like, look at what our species can do when we kind of put ourselves to the task.
But we still depend on Russian rocketry, don't we?
We do. And, you know, and there's a strong case to be made for, you know, increased focus on American development there. And I think we're getting there. You know, I think the SpaceX obviously is an American endeavor. We are currently still relying on that. But I think that's kind of a temporary moment. And then we'll transition back to sort of the American know-how. And it's good for us to have that ability. I think one of the things that you kind of want to remember, and it, you know, it's an obvious example of sort of the space shuttle, is when you're reliant on one technology, whether it be Russian or even just American, to get you to International Space Station, and there's an issue with that, you have no alternative. You know, with the Columbia, we were set back for, you know, over a year in terms of Hubble repair mission. So I think, you know, you want to have this diversity of options. And the great thing about the commercial space industry, they are, you know, kind of by default having a diversity there.
What other things are on the drawing board as possibilities at JPL?
So we have a bunch of missions coming up. We've got a 2016 mission that just got approved to be built.
What's that?
It's called InSight. It's going to Mars. It's taking the design that we had for Mars Phoenix and applying it to a landed mission. Again, so another lander instead of a rover this time. And this one will look for kind of the past of Mars in terms of tectonics and activity, and we'll have both a seismometer and a probe to measure heat flux from the core. Because we want to understand, again, one of the things we don't fully understand about Mars is why it's kind of much cooler than Earth, right? It doesn't have a magnetic field like Earth does. So it's had a different history than Earth has, and it kind of helps us to piece together the puzzle of why Mars isn't the same place as Earth. You know, even though it's our neighbor, you know, you look at your neighbor's house and you want to understand why his lawn isn't growing.
Where did all that water go?
Exactly. Right. And along with that, we have a mission getting there this fall called MAVEN, and that's looking for atmospheric measurements, and that'll help us understand the atmospheric changes of Mars. And then in 2020, we kind of follow that up with, the big one, which is sort of a Curiosity follow-on mission. And that one is going to look more directly for evidence of past life on Mars.
Mm-hmm. I'm Ira Flato. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with Babak Firdausi, NASA engineer, and waiting to send a mission to Europa. Do you get into the argument about whether it's better to send a person, let's send an astronaut to Mars, with people who say, you know, the robots are much cheaper to do that?
It's always a debate, and you know what? We're very honest about it, which we, you know, you could say that what Curiosity has done in over a year is probably what one person could do in about a day or two.
The whole year
one day. Yeah, so I mean, it's that intuition as a human. You know, you have perspective. You can walk a lot faster than the rover can drive, because you don't need a ground crew telling you where to walk.
Just need a hammer.
Yeah, you just need a hammer, and you grab samples. And, you know, that's the thing. We can grab a bunch of samples on a human mission and bring them back quickly, but the cost is, you know, at least tenfold of what a Curiosity costs. So at this point, you know, the best we can do is a robotic mission. That being said, I think the future will bring more and more of a shared kind of human robotic exploration strategy. And you see a little bit of on the space station right now. There's an increasing, you know, presence of robots. The Canadians have Dexter, which is a, you know, robot they can entirely operate from the ground here on Earth, but sits on the International Space Station. But one of the biggest challenges we have is just, you know, that one-way light time. You know, when we landed, it was 14 minutes each way at the speed of light between Mars and Earth. So you can't, you know, there's no kind of driving with a joystick sort of thing. Everything has to be sort of thought out the day before.
There are a lot of people who say that a trip to Mars is so risky that it's going to require a one-way mission. And what do you think about?
I don't think NASA's in the business of one-way missions, so I don't think that, you know, you'll hear us say that that's the solution. But there are private companies like Mars One that are out there saying that's the affordable way of doing Mars is sending people on a one-way trip. The amazing thing to me is how many people were engaged and willing to do that, you know, willing to be the first pioneers.
I'm sure you're not one of them.
Earth. I love our planet. I'm a big proponent of the reasons to study other places is only in many ways to appreciate our own planet. But it is certainly cheaper. If you don't have to bring people back, it's a lot cheaper.
Well, that's also, you bring up a very interesting point is that, about looking down NASA is now looking down at our planet and a lot of the missions. A lot of the things we know about global warming and ocean currents and hurricanes come from NASA's research, doesn't it?
That's right. And even, you know, the NOAA, the National Oceanographic Institute, they use a lot of the NASA data to understand the weather patterns. And another mission this fall called SMAP, which is Soil Moisture Active Passive. So, and you know, what we're doing is we're building these kind of near real-time maps. You know, SMAP, for example, gets an entire coverage of the Earth within 2 to 3 days. So you have a kind of a real-time map happening on Earth, and we can better understand, you know, in the short term, agriculture and where to plant and do things like that. But in the long term, we can sort of understand one of the big concerns we have, which is where is the water on Earth, and then, you know, and also the carbon dioxide, which we know is affecting that system. Mm-hmm. And it's really important. So this year we're calling the year of Earth at NASA, and you know, it's kind of there's a lot of Earth observation missions that are happening.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to thank my guest, Babak Ferdowsi, currently Europa Clipper Mission Engineer at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. Thank you, Babak.
Thank you.